We'll walk. Don Moy happily started reeling them in. How will you pay? We don't know. Get a loan. And they did get loans. The going interest rates from local loan sharks for money lent against a plot of land was 15% compounded monthly. They put up their land. A few made deals with Don Moy himself, more than happy to offer them loans against future earnings in the United States. What was $1,700 or $1,800 when you were going to be rolling in dólares gringos? A few words with his trusted associate, the mighty Chespiro in Hidalgo, and the loan would be approved. A slight down payment now, Don Moy murmured, whatever they could afford, and a reasonable payment schedule at a slightly higher percentage rate. After all, Don Moy was taking a great risk in not only delivering them, but trusting them to pay him back, and he needed to be rewarded for his trust. A good deal all around, Don Moy would have said. And of course they would pay him back. Chespiro. Well, Chespiro. Don Moy made it clear that he couldn't be responsible for Chespiro's wrath should they shirk their responsibilities to him. They might vanish into the United States, start life anew, be safe forever. Who could find them? If the INS didn't find Mexicans, poor old Don Moy couldn't either. But Chespiro, he knew where all the wives and children lived. It was too ugly to discuss, too unpleasant to even consider, so they all agreed that Chespiro should be given no cause to visit the families late in the night. How soon do we go? They wanted to know. Takes time. But don't worry, boys. We'll see what we can do. His cell phone was sitting next to his coffee. They shook hands. His belly touched the edge of the table. He smiled. Raimundo Barreda was a mestizo, indigenous on his mother's side. Her last name was Maruri, and in the Mexican fashion, he bore her name as well, Barreda Maruri. He was a mature man, a strong, hard worker with a cowboy's aspect. He favored Western wear. His favorite belt buckle, for example, was in the shape of a silver spur. He wore silver rather than gold, either from preference or due to lower cost. His watch was on a faux silver band. He was a soda bottler by trade when he wasn't tending his land. He had resolved to go north to expand and re-roof his small house as a gift to his wife. A summer of orange picking was all he had in mind. He had already figured out the cost of cement block and aluminum roofing and a couple of bags of cement. Florida. It was warm like Mexico, sunny, pleasant. His pride and joy was his son, Raimundo Jr. At 15, Raimundo was a sturdy student in the regional school system, and he had distinguished himself as a star of the local soccer leagues. Every teen dreams of notoriety or fame, and perhaps Raimundo could develop his soccer skills and play professionally. The thought did cross his mind when he was charging down the field, full of strength. He had the sheer faith in his father and life that could be expected from a kid whose name meant King of the World. In a surprise gesture of loyalty to his father, Raimundo Jr. asked to go along on the trip. He convinced his father by explaining to him that two strong backs could earn more money in a short time than one. And if they both worked like burros all summer, they'd make double the money. They might buy his mother furniture to go in the new room. For them, the planned trip was a gesture of love. Raimundo Sr. was worried about his son's well-being. The boy was restless and hungry for adventure. The old man was pretty sure his boy would go off alone if he didn't take him, and he thought of his own lonely journey ahead. When it came time to sit across from Don Moy, he was troubled, but reluctantly he signed himself and the boy onto the roster. Naum Landa was a dark young man in his 20s with a melodious voice. He had deep, black, shaggy hair. Sometimes you had to lean in to hear him speak. His meeting with Moises was oddly biblical. Two men with Old Testament names haggled over details of their exodus. It seemed like a good idea. Naum was the brother-in-law of Raimundo Sr. If the extended family went together, they could look out for each other. Naum was deceptive. His quiet voice, with its melodic quickness, its slightly slurred words, and his sometimes evasive gaze, hid the strong man behind the facade. Naum was a natural leader. He had no doubt he would survive, no matter what happened to them, and his boys signed up with him, looking to him as a guardian. There were others signing up. Enrique Landeros Garcia was 30 years old. His wife, Octavia, was only 23. They had a son named Alexis. He had recently turned 7, and he was ready for school, but Enrique and Octavia didn't have the kind of money school required. Although the Mexican system used uniforms to standardize all classes of students, you had to first have the uniform. Shoes, supplies, tuition. Enrique made his way to Don Moy's table for little Alexis, a small illegal venture to pay for a more straightforward chance at a future. Reino Bartolo Hernandez was 37 years old. He was one of the older men in the crew. He and his wife Agustina had been married for 19 years. Theirs was a stable household. It could even be called an established home. After their years together, however, they'd decided to adopt a daughter. Reino went to Don Moy for money to pay for her care. He didn't have many clothes to take, though he did put aside his favorite green pants for the long walk. Mario Castillo Fernandez was a handsome young man of 25. He was in good condition, a hard worker, his only curse, poverty. His wife Irma was fiercely dedicated to him. Their love was still strong, though they'd been together since their teens. They had 2 young children, and like Enrique Landeros, Mario was facing school with no prospects for greater income. And, knowing his love for Irma, there would be more children. Perhaps he could build a better house, add a room, send the children to school in good pants with new backpacks known as mochilas. Maybe he could buy Irma new furniture. The rumor said he could get to Florida, where it was warm, like home, pick oranges. How bad could that be? He liked oranges. He wasn't afraid to work. He added his name to the list. Don Moy drove from town to town, patient, happy. He called Chespiro, his shadowy boss in Hidalgo. Yes, yes, it's going well, jefe. I have them lined up. Several already, 7, 8. Don't worry, I'll get more. Chapter 3. The Coyote and the Chicken. There are things, unlikely as it seems, that unite the Mexican Consular Corps and the Border Patrol. In consulates, names of certain Border Patrol officers are spoken with respect, even affection. Ryan Scudder of Tucson is called a gentleman. Mike McGlasson of Yuma is looked on with respect. Ken Smith at Welton is mentioned as a kind of patriarch of the wasteland. The Welton boys like the Calexico consul and the Yuma consul, and they have a pretty good feeling about the Mexican Beta Group cops, who are the elite agents investigating narco and coyote crimes on the Mexican side. Aside from that, they seem to see lots of the other Mexicans as communists and thieves. But the two things that most unify the two sides are each one's deep distrust of its own government and each side's simmering hatred for the human smugglers, the gangsters who call themselves coyotes. The sign is printed in black and blue and red on a white banner. It faces south. They have spent good money on it. For the coyotes, your needs are only a business, and they don't care about your safety or the safety of your family. Don't pay them off with your lives. The sign has been posted by the Mexican government at Sasabe, Sonora. It is as absurd a placard as might have been posted by the U.S. government. Policy wonks in Washington, D.C. are as ineffectual as policy wonks in Mexico, D.F. There is no real border here, just a tattered barbed wire fence, a dusty plain, and some rattling bushes. Walkers face the Brawley Wash and the Sierrita Mountains coming up from Mexico. Don Moy never bothered with Sasabe. He wasn't a walker. For Don Moy, the conspiracy was a thing of buses, the Tres Estrellas and Transportes Norte del Pacifico bus lines. Then a quick night tossing and turning in a Sonoita or San Luis or Douglas motel, a wad of colorful Mexican pesos, and a nice lunch, and back home on the bus. It was all Playboys and American cigarettes, a tequila, maybe some girls. And so long, boys, I'm going home. The border was the problem of others. The Sasabe sign, which many of the walkers can't read, is the only thing Mexico is doing to try to stop them from crossing. The Mexican army patrols the borderlands, sort of, though nobody can find them, probably because the coyotes pay the soldiers off. Coyote gangs have more money than the Mexico City sign painters. What do Mexican soldiers care if alambristas, wire crossers, walk into Arizona? Any one of the soldiers might very well head north himself at some point. For a while, the Mexican government offered the walkers survival kits with water and snacks, but the uproar from the United States put a stop to that. Americans saw these attempts at life-saving as a combination invitation to invade and complimentary picnic basket. They were further astonished to learn that Mexico City officials put condoms into the boxes. Of course, Mexico City claimed this was a gesture of deep consideration for the health of all involved. Gringos were deeply alarmed that the illegals were not just coming over to work, but to get laid. They're coming for our daughters. They're coming to make welfare babies. They're coming to party, party, party. 1,500 walkers a day depart from under the Sasabe sign. The writer Charles Bowden, on a visit to Sasabe in 2003, counted 5,000 walkers in one afternoon. Although our Welton 26 did not cross at the sign, their trail leads to the region surrounding it. The Lukeville Organ Pipe border was too busy for them, so they scooted off to the side and tried to backtrack to the Lukeville paths once they were in the United States. No matter where they entered, they had only to step over a drooping bit of wire fence or across an invisible line in the dust. Near the legendary crossing at El Saguaro, there is often no fence at all. Along the Devil's Highway near Tinajas Altas, there is nothing but a dry creek bed and a small sign telling walkers, "Y'all better stay out or else we'll be, like, really, really bummed." Tucson's newspapers described their entry as having been somewhere between Yuma and Nogales. This is a safe bet. A cursory glance at a map will reveal that most of the state lies between Yuma and Nogales. Several accounts say they crossed at a tiny burg called Los Vidrios, not to be confused with the Vidrios Drag. A woman named Ofelia or Aurelia, depends on who you ask, Alvarado runs a small truck stop at Los Vidrios. Many walkers stop at her store before they cross over. Near Mrs. Alvarado's store are signs that warn walkers, USA, USA, prohibido. Walkers see them, scratch their heads, and continue. At best, the signs imply, in bad Spanish, to use is prohibited. To use what? The trail? The sign? The desert? Spanish? Nobody, it seems, told the Yankees who put the signs up that in Mexico, USA, is spelled E-E-U-U. Mrs. Alvarado never saw the welt in 26. She told reporters that a young man had gone a few days before they did, and he'd returned burned black and vomiting blood after they'd left. He told her God was coming to get him. So Los Vidrios is generally reported was not their crossing point. Most of the survivors say they crossed at El Papalote. That would be a tiny scatter of wrecks and huts whose name translates as the kite. The trail probably led them into the Quitobaquito Hills. These confusions and guesses should suggest why it's so difficult to enforce immigration law on the border. Of the men confirmed to have survived from the group, none can agree on where exactly they entered the United States. Perhaps only one person knew where they were trying to go once they were here, and that was their coyote. From El Papalote, it seems like the myth of the big bad border is just a fairy tale. One step and presto, you're in the E-E-U-U Los Estados Unidos, the United States. There is nothing there. No helicopters, no trucks, no soldiers. There's a tarantula, a creosote bush, a couple of beat saguaros dying of dry rot, some scattered bits of trash, old human and coyote turds in the bushes, now mummified into little coal nuggets. Nothing. The smugglers tell the walkers it's just a day's walk to their pickup point. If they are crossing into Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument, it's literally a walk in the park. A couple of hours heading north for Ajo, Arizona, cold soda pop, and a ride to work. How bad can it be? A day of thirst? Some physical struggle? They've lived like that all their lives. The place may be alien to them, but the situation feels like home. After all, they tell themselves, America's a country with a state called Nuevo México. Other states are called red, Colorado, snowy, Nevada, mountain, Montana, and flowery, Florida. Several of them were going to Flowery, and some of the others were going to Northern Carolina to see about making cigarettes. The state of Nuevo México even has a capital city called Holy Faith, Santa Fe. Catholicism, New Mexico. And then there's the hilarious Chicago. Chi, piss, and cago, I shit. It's funny, until they feel the cold of winter. Illegal entry is the sole reason for Sasabes or El Papalotes or Vidrios's existence. The vans lined up under the spindly cottonwoods have driven from Altar, Sonora, full of walkers. Don Moy was quite familiar with Altar. The bus stopped there, and he often hit the cell phone to check with his bosses. Should the walkers hop off in Altar and grab a guide for the Sasabe line, or should they go on to Sonoita to take part in a more complex conspiracy? Several of our Welton 26 stopped over in Altar, and it was the merest whim of the head coyote that put the Yuma 14 Welton 26 on the bus to Sonoita instead of in a wasted Ford van heading for Oregon Pipe. Maybe the big man was watching MTV. Maybe he was heading for the toilet or looking for a smoke. He had his phone in one hand, he spoke one word, and on they went to their ordeal. By the time they were finally rescued, they could have been in Miami. The ne'er-do-well fence jumpers that galloped into El Paso and San Diego on a quest for chocolate shakes and Michael Jackson cassettes are no more. The new Jack Coyote is largely the inadvertent product of the Border Patrol's extremely effective interdiction and prevention policies. Good old Operation Gatekeeper is the mother of invention. San Diego's Border Patrol beefed up the border fence, then placed massive floodlights along it, illuminating the no man's land between the United States and Mexico. Then, in a burst of creative thinking, it ceased the endless patrolling of the hills and river valleys of the region. Instead, the Border Patrol parked trucks at half-mile checkpoints all along the fence. Each agent is in sight of the next, and all of them are in constant contact as they observe the line. Helicopters still hover, and their versions of the Oscar sensors blip, and night vision electric eyes scan. The fence in the west extends into the ocean. In the east, it terminates in the wasteland of deserts and mountains. Unimaginable developments followed. In the region of San Isidro, the last small town before you get to the Mexican border, at the last U.S. exit off I-5, a big sparkling suburb has sprung up. In this area, formerly notorious as a human hunting ground, a dangerous waste of crime and panic, junkies and gunfights, there are now soccer fields and two-story houses that look like they could be in a subdivision of Denver. At the end of all the cul-de-sacs in the development, there's a high wall and football stadium floodlights pointing south. Some of the new Latino middle class once crossed that very land in a mad scuttle. Now, teens in the neighborhood climb up on their backyard sheds to watch the action in the Tijuana River floodplain. The hundreds of walkers who once ran this gauntlet are now forced to move east. They rarely try to swim around the western barrier, and if they do, they land in a state park where fishermen, casting into the surf, are often armed feds. The only way to go is out there, back of beyond, away from civilization. And if you go far enough, the fence devolves into a 2-foot-high road barrier you can step over. Farther still, and you're in territory much like Sasabe. There are approximately 2,000 miles of this kind of terrain to enter. This new paradigm, walkers crossing desolation in place of jumping urban fences, has made Altar the largest center of illegal immigration on the entire border. The Central Park Plaza in town is full of coyotes and walkers. A 5-minute visit to the park will garner several offers to cross. Coyotes hawk destinations like crack dealers in the Bronx sell drugs. Voices murmur options from a memorized menu. Los Angeles, Chicago, Florida. The backs of the Altar vans have plastic milk jugs of water for sale. On the front of each van is a sign made of masking tape, and it says Sasabe or Frontera, Carolina Norte, Carolina Sur, Nueva York. The main grocery store in Sasabe, hardly a supermarket, is winkingly called Super El Coyote. The Mexican government's border sign near Sasabe doesn't actually say coyotes. It uses the hipper slang of the border. It says Los Polleros. A pollero would be a chicken wrangler. The level of esteem the smugglers hold for their charges is stated plainly. They're simply chickens. Of course, if you know Spanish, you know that the word for chicken is gallina. Pollo is usually reserved for something else. A pollo, as in arroz con pollo, has been cooked. Now, more than ever, walkers need a coyote. In the new organized crime hierarchies of human smuggling, the actual coyotes are middle management thugs. The old coyote, the scruffy punk leading a ragtag group of Guatemalans into San Diego via the bogs and industrial parks of Chula Vista, is rapidly becoming extinct. You will still encounter a dope fiend who will walk you into the infrared night vision RoboCop scrub for $50, or the homeboy in the Impala who blusters you through the line by being a Chicano heading home to the barrio after hitting the bars. But he's being replaced by the new breed, and woe to that crackhead if the young Turks get hold of him. He'll be found with his hands tied behind his back and a 9mm slug in his brain pan. Even asking questions about these criminals is considered dangerous. Queries into the coyote operation behind the Yuma 14 catastrophe, for example, elicit 3 different warnings about being shot in the head. One gets the feeling that the entire world of coyotes is waiting, waiting to merge with the narcotraficante underworld, immortalized by Norteño music and movies such as Traffic, waiting to hook more deeply into the white slavery and sex slavery and child labor rings of the world, waiting for a human smuggling visionary to unify them. Gangs are so in control now that walkers who want to go alone without a pollero to guide them must pay a fee just to enter the desert. Criminals are at the gate of Disneyland. They're scalping tickets, and they're scalping each other. The criminal operation that lured the Yuma 14 and their companions into the desert and abandoned them was not the biggest by far. But it was well established, and it operated out of Phoenix, Arizona, and the Mexican state of Hidalgo. It was a family operation. The main man, the Tony Soprano figure, lived in the United States, or maybe he lived in Hidalgo. He liked to wear cowboy boots, and he kept his figure slim. Or he was never seen by the troops. A voice on the phone. In Phoenix, it was Luis Cercas. Luis Cercas, at the time of the Yuma 14 deaths, had contacts in Florida, Illinois, and California. He had a Florida associate, Don Francisco Vasquez, and another roving associate was placed in Mexico. He was the brother of Luis, Daniel Cercas, and he lived in Hidalgo. Like all of the smugglers, Daniel had an alias, El Chespiro, derived in part from Chespirito, the cloying little red cricket of Mexican kids' TV. Chespiro. Did some of the walkers think Don Moy was in touch with the television star? Did some of them secretly believe that Chespirito, the red cricket, was a massively powerful gangster? It made a kind of sense to the Mexican mind. Stranger things had happened. This Chespiro never met the bottom feeders of the gang face to face. He kept in contact via cell phone. All payments went to Chespiro, and all payouts allegedly came from Chespiro. Chespiro sent people to Sonoita from all over Mexico. A sister-in-law worked in Phoenix running the administration of the corporation. She organized pickups and human deposits in the double-wides and barrio apartment safe houses. One of these drop-offs is known to have been on Peoria Street in Phoenix. A step beneath Luis and Chespiro Cercas and their sister-in-law were the soldiers and drivers and guides. In the Yuma 14 case, the coyote was a shadowy and notorious figure known as El Negro, with the wonderful Mexican bandito name of Evodio Manilla. He had the universal black mustache. He was short and thin with an aquiline nose, and a haircut that in reports sounds like it was a mullet. He wore gold chains around his neck, and he had a curious head-bobbing walk. He had 3 vehicles, and all of them might have been white. El Negro was also alleged to be the brother-in-law of Luis. Bada bing. It's a family thing. El Negro apparently worked his way up from an early life as a guide. It was said he never crossed into the United States for any reason once he achieved middle management status. At the time, he was about 28. El Negro, dreaded enforcer and manipulator of Sonoita Sonora, had a driver known as El Moreno. The black man and the dark man. Scary. El Moreno affected the black border mustache like his boss, and his round face had a scar slanting down the left side. The combination of the scar and the stash made him a really convincing bandido. El Moreno was described as robust in the investigation documents. In Sonoita, El Negro and El Moreno lived together in criminal bliss in a house described as being around the corner from an evangelical temple on the west side of town. Local directions are simple. Go to the road to San Luis Rio Colorado. El Negro's house is there between the templo and a disco called Angelo. Jesus Christ on one side and Party Hardy on the other. El Negro sometimes danced at Angelo with his girlfriend Lorena. Lorena seems to be one of the only people in Sonora not involved with the smuggling gang. Immune to prosecution, Chespiro oversaw El Negro and El Moreno via long-distance cell phone, and they, in turn, commanded a small army of soldiers. These were secondary drivers, guards, enforcers, and guías, or guides. Today, these guides are what we used to think of as coyotes. They actually cut sign, make trails, and lead the walkers into the desert. Young men, mostly, who are as disposable as the pollos. They can die as easily as the walkers, and the organization will not be hurt. There are always more fools willing. Smugglers pay locals, like drug lords in the inner city pay off shorties and grandmothers, to cover their operations, runners, lookouts. Imagine living in a burning cement brick oven in Sells, Arizona. A guy comes along and offers you $200 to let him park his van behind your house for 2 days. Maybe he offers you $500 to go sleep at your mom's trailer while he waits. You'd be crazy not to take it. The Cercas crew had a favorite illegal entrant pickup spot in the United States. Mile marker 27 on Highway 86 on the Oodham Reservation. Or mile marker 27 or 21 on Highway 85. No one can agree. The Devil's Highway forecasts are always for sun, heat, and impenetrable fog. But wherever the pickup spot was, when a load of walkers was due, a woman named Teresa would drive up and down the road after dark. Thin, with long black hair, she is our Matahari. Teresa must have been bold. Even cops don't like to be out there in the dark. The guía would gather his chickens at the mile marker post, and Teresa would then spot them on the drive-by. She'd speed dial a transport on her cell phone, and one or two vans would depart from their prearranged parking spots. The walkers squeezed out of the urban corridors are relying more and more on the reservation. They cost the Indians millions of dollars a year in cleanup, rescue, enforcement, and land restoration. Hundreds of pounds of garbage accrue yearly. Bottles, pants, tampons, paper, toilet paper, corpses. And the migra barrels through in their trucks. This may help to explain some of the frayed relationships between the Border Patrol and the Oodham people on the res. The Cercas gang's western operation centered on Yuma and Welton. Their central operation delivered walkers to the Mohawk rest area on I-8, and the eastern operation, which ultimately killed the Yuma 14, targeted Ajo. Ajo, Garlic is a small mining town not far from Hawaii. Locals quip, why not? And good question. It's near the reservation, and it's a straight shot to Gila Bend in one direction and Tucson in another. The Cercas drivers got Teresa's call and sped onto 86, mindful of Border Patrol vehicles or the unlikely sheriff's cruisers, cut north on 85, pull up at marker 27, throw open the doors and hustle them in, slam the doors and be gone. If you were slow or ill and you missed the van, there you were, waiting for whatever fate would find you. Recently, a young woman was found dead beside I-8. Someone had dragged her out of the desert and left her like a bag of litter on the shoulder. It is entirely possible that she simply couldn't manage the fast upload into the van and was left to stare at the stars as they drove away. One can imagine the tiresome complications of dealing with a dead or dying woman in Phoenix. The coyotes are stone-cold pragmatists. Perhaps somebody kicked her out of the van. It was a big freeway. She still had a shot. By desert standards, it was a tender act. The Cercas' vans would hustle onto I-10 and deliver their loads to Phoenix, where the illegals would squat in safe houses guarded by gangbangers until they could be shuffled off into wider America. Their United States travel was arranged by Big Brother Luis, king of the freeway. All it took was a van, a truck, a car with a big back seat or a roomy trunk, a rear seat on a Trailways bus. Luis, Daniel, El Negro, and El Moreno plied their trade in the vast reaches of the Cabeza Prieta wilderness. El Negro, El Moreno, and the Dark Head Desert. It sounds like a Mexican translation of an H.P. Lovecraft story. It will shock no one to learn that Don Moy was said to be yet another relative of the prolific Cercas family. So this was their system. The Cercas familia controlled the operation from Phoenix. Fixers in other states procured jobs for a fee. Daniel recruited the polleros and the guías for transport of walkers to these jobs, and he oversaw the tides of money, and he made the complex arrangements for housing and transport. Don Moy recruited the walkers. His title was enganchador, or the hooker. El Negro enforced and organized the shady doings in Sonora. El Moreno supervised the transport to the launching pad, where the walkers stepped off on a forsaken piece of desert on the brink of El Camino del Diablo, and he sometimes drove. At the bottom, there was the guía. Chapter 4. El Guía. Three guides led the Welton 26 into the desert. One will forever remain anonymous. One is only known by a code name, and one became infamous in the borderland. Guides are mostly tough boys who earn $100 a head every time they lead a group across the border. They never reveal their real names, so if they die, they are fated to lie in the potter's fields of Tucson and Yuma. Each one has a code name, so the chickens cannot later identify him, and each one wears bad clothes, so he blends in should the group be apprehended. An army of border trash. The three guides that walked the Welton 26 have few things to their credit, but one was the fact that they did not feed their pollos any drugs. Guillas now give their walkers cocaine to make them walk faster and longer. Of course, cocaine helps their hearts explode, too. If the guía has been paid in advance, he doesn't care if you get to your toilet-scrubbing job or not. It's easier for him, frankly, if you drop and return to dust in the middle of the Devil's Highway. In 2003, it was reported in the Arizona Press that low-rent coyotes were using a new chemical prod to speed up their walkers. It turns out that ephedra-based diet pills are cheaper, effective, and easily available. The apparent coyote favorites are over-the-counter fat burners. A dose of 8 pills at a time really gets them hustling. The leader of the Welton 26 group was a 19-year-old boy from Guadalajara. If he hadn't inadvertently killed his clients, he would have made about $3,000 from the walk, which he'd probably split with his two associates. It was the biggest group he had guided. Most of them were smaller, parties of 12 or 18. 12, say, at $100 to $150 a head, 5 times a month. He had trained and plied his trade in the Yuma area first, having commuted west from Nogales. He'd worked the drags out of Tinajas Altas Pass and up around the ABC peaks where the Welton sign cutters patrolled. At some point in the past, he might have been apprehended by Kenny Smith or Officer Friendly or even Mike F., caught, boxed up, and sent back home, only to cross again another night. He wore his hair in a silly punk rock style, cut short all around with a red-dyed forelock hanging over his eye. He liked to flick it back over his head like an enemy's scalp plopped on his skull. Some survivors said the hair was orange or blonde. To them, anything not black was blonde. They didn't know his name, but they all remembered the Dew. Border Patrol agents still refer to him as Rooster Boy. A couple of months before the disaster, in one of his other border busts, a federal judge had officially deported Rooster Boy. Sadly for everyone, he came back again. At the time of the last walk, he lived in a run-down white house in Sonoita with his girlfriend, Celia Lomas Mendez. The house was down at the end of the paved half of Altar Street, number 67. He slept with her on a mattress and bed spring resting on the floor of a back room, cement, shadowy. The occasional palm tree rustled in the hot desert breeze. Beyond the end of the paved part of Altar lived his best friend, Rodrigo Maradona, another guía. Rodrigo lived on a dirt and stone alley, but he was close to his pal. El Negro had provided them with cell phones. They're all cybernauts, these polleros, instant messaging and paging and selling each other like giddy teeny boppers in a shopping mall. They didn't have proper plumbing, but they had the hookup. Our boy's Mexican cellular number was 65-13-85-21. His smuggling code name was Mendez, a romantic gesture in honor of his sweetheart. He still occasionally goes by his middle name, Antonio. Such was his idea of an alias, Antonio López Ramos, a.k.a. Mendez. He had another alias, too. His boyhood nickname among his friends was sometimes Chewy, the diminutive of Jesus. This is his true name, Jesus. Jesus led the walkers gathered by Moses into the desert called Desolation. Jesus has the inevitable birthday of December 25th. By way of this letter, I ask forgiveness and pardon for what happened in the Arizona desert, because I really am sorry from the bottom of my heart for what happened, and it honestly wasn't my intention to lead those people to their deaths. Rather, my intention was to help them cross the border, but we never imagined the tragedy would happen. But he did. He imagined it. It was no secret, this chance of death. Every week, walkers are left to die by their guías. It is so common that it must be seen as a standard coyote practice, a business move. Welton agents will tell you any number of heinous stories, as will the Mexican consular corps, like the group jammed into a van that cut across the Devil's Highway on a mad dog cross-country run. Once in the United States, the van broke down. The walkers were at least 30 miles from the freeway. The driver told them it was an easy 5-mile walk, then he set the van on fire to keep it out of the hands of the Border Patrol, said he was going to fetch a fresh van, and he'd be back to pick them up farther along the trail. He, of course, never returned. Many of the walkers died on that stroll. One of them was a pregnant 19-year-old woman. In the summer of 2002, an idiot pollero driver with 23 pollos on board went the wrong way on Interstate 8 in California. Lights out. He was trying to avoid a Border Patrol checkpoint. His van crashed head-on into a Ford Explorer and sent it flying off an embankment, killing Larry Baca and nearly killing his fiancée. The hurtling van demolished 4 cars before finally stopping, twisted beyond description. This kind of smash-up bears a wry acronym among law enforcement wags. DWM. Driving while Mexican. At least the driver of the van had the good taste to die for his sins. 4 of his pollos also died. One of the dead was a Brazilian, and other Brazilians are believed to have been crammed into the van. Some reports list an astonishing 33 riders. This brings to mind the hoary old joke, question, why did Santa Anna only take 6,000 troops to the Alamo? Answer, because he only had 1 Chevy. The guía that time was a 25-year-old former Mexican field worker named Alfredo Álvarez Coronado. He was paid by an organization that gave him the cut-rate salary of $300 per load. Our man Mendez would have scoffed at that minimum wage paycheck, but Alfredo Álvarez said he earned so little in Mexico, 100 pesos a day, about $10, that the pollero work was a windfall. 1 walk, 1 month's salary. Alfredo's walkers had been charged between $1,300 and $1,500 a head for the hike and ride. The drivers in this particular gang were suspected of at least 8 other dangerous wrong-way drives on California freeways. 31 of the illegals from the crash ended up in the hospital. It can be fairly assumed that the organization that lured them across did not volunteer to pay these hospital bills. Unfortunate third-class passengers who can't afford a ride on a car seat are locked in the trunk. Some of them are actually strapped to the engine blocks. In the trade, these rides are known as coffin loads. I want you to know that since my childhood, my parents have always been of very low economical resources. My parents had to make great efforts just to feed us each day. I was forced to leave school because they didn't have enough economic means to send all 4 of us children to school. So I decided to leave my family and look for work and make good money to help my family make ends meet and buy them a house, since they don't own their own home. I worked legitimately at a factory making roof tiles in Nogales, Sonora. The wages were truly very low, and that was my reason for getting involved in the smuggling business. It didn't take long for El Negro's agents to find Mendez. He was exactly like the walkers he would later lead, poor, alone, looking for a better life, willing to do what it takes. Like them, he was recruited. Like them, he was welcome to die for the Cercas brothers. There were many more waiting to take his place. There were so many more of him that he didn't even exist. Mendez and the walkers didn't know they were invisible. On the Devil's Highway, you had to almost die for anybody to notice your face. Chapter 5. Jesus Walks Among Us. In the Sheriff's Department videos, the survivors' faces are almost black against the stark white hospital pillows. The camera zooms in close to them. Their features are overwhelmed by the glare. They're nearly invisible in the brutal light. They wear ridiculous flowered hospital gowns. Many have oxygen hoses plugged into their noses. They are all still weak. Some have IV bottles leaking saline into their veins. A few of them have lips so swollen and cracked that they can barely talk. They hold wadded cloths to their mouths to catch the drool that keeps leaking out. During one interview, a nurse bursts in and says, "We need urine." The man looks down at her and nods, then tries to keep talking as she collects his fluids. They are in shock. They can't spell their own names. They can't spell the names of the villages and ranches they came from. They look to the deputies, as if the Americans can help them remember the letters. They don't know what day it is. They don't know the name of where they were. When they mention Sonoita, they call it Sonorita, or Little Sonora. "Do you know which direction you traveled?" the sheriff asks one man. He thinks for a moment, then nods. "Yes, I remember," he says. He gestures straight ahead with one hand. "That way," he says. "Do you know who the coyotes are?" "I don't know who they are." "Are they here in the hospital?" Looking around, "Are they here in the hospital?" "Okay. When you crossed from Sonoita, who was leading you?" "I don't know who was leading us." "How much did you pay?" "I didn't pay anything to anybody." "Oh, sure. They brought you for free." Looks away. Well, you know, it was handled by the legendary Negro. It was probably paid by my brother." "Is he here? My brother's here? Did he cross with you?" "My brother? I grew up with him." "How do we get in touch with this legendary Negro?" "Oh, fuck. How old is he? How am I supposed to know how old he is?" "How old was the guide?" "Normal. He was a regular age." "What did he look like?" "He had that stupid red punk rock haircut hanging down in front." Jesus had once come from the south, too. He first came north from Guadalajara looking for work. No one knows if he imagined crossing illegally or not, but whether he crossed over or stayed in the Mexican border region, he would earn more money there than he would at home. He had wanted to buy his mother a house. He had kicked around for a while, never made it into the United States if that was his plan, and somehow ended up in Nogales, Sonora. It's a lively little town, just across the line from the somnambulant burg of Nogales, Arizona, straight down I-19 from Tucson. Jesus had worked in a brickyard, the San Antonio Tile Works, in sunburned Colonia Virreyes. He had cursed his fate, looking for a way out. This was no way to live, and it certainly wasn't going to get him a Cadillac or his mama a house. For whatever reason, he hadn't wanted to get into the drug smuggling world, and he had shied away from the teeming world of possibility that was Tijuana. Coming to Nogales in search of success had not been a sign of tactical genius. In the winter of 2000, he met Rodrigo Maradona, who worked the mud beside him. They hung out socially, became friends. Maradona was a real hustler, moonlighting after his long days in the tile works at an altogether more interesting job. In later testimony, as his story shifted, Rooster Boy said Chespirito himself appeared like the devil in the sunny brickyard. Chespirito appeared and whispered temptations in his ear. It's one of the small mysteries of the story. A little more of that border fog bank. Maradona was 18, thin. He had a badass tattoo of Christ on his chest. Another Chico Banda, rockin' dude. No doubt Jesus let Maradona know that he was aching to make some real money. Well, well, well. It just so happened that Maradona was a part-time coyote, and he was making great money. He was earning $100 U.S. for each pollo he took across the line. $100? Shit, brother. Jesus wasn't making $100 a week. $100 a week? No seas pendejo, Chuy. Maradona was making $1,000 a week. The beer sloshed. The smoke rose. Jesus would sure like to get into some pinche money like that. Maradona told him he could be living large any time. It was sounding good. Maradona told him stories, the thrill of outfoxing the goddamn migra, the excitement of finding yourself alone in the desert with some fine foxy lady, the stuff you could buy. The coyotes and polleros didn't call each other coyotes. That was one of the first things Jesus had to do if he didn't want to sound like the Guadalajara hick that he was. He had to get with it. He had to agarra la onda, güey. He was ready to get la onda. Okay, Maradona told him. Polleros called each other gangsters. Not gangbangers, who were pandilleros. Not thieves, who were rateros. And not bandits, who were bajaderos. Honest to God, Tony Montana, Scarface, gangsters. Cars, money, malls, gold rings, and they indulged their vices to the hilt. They liked their dope, mota, and they liked getting drunk, andando pedo, and they loved their dogfights and their cockfights. It was heady. One thing was for sure, no full-time gangster ever had adobe caked under his nails. Maradona wove the web. There was only one problem. Nogales was dying. The migra had the desert sector near town shut down tight. They had been adapting the El Paso formula. Big new fences, some kind of human radar, night vision, and more cops. The bastards parked their trucks in a line, each truck in sight of the next, and they just sat there. They watched for hours, drinking sodas, clicking their radios. Everybody in Nogales said they handcuffed morras, girls, in the trucks, and felt their chichis. Pinche migra. So right now, the action was focusing out west, a mean town below the Yuma border called San Luis Rio Colorado. Órale, it sucked, all right? The dying, salty remnant of the Colorado River oozed by, picking up green chemicals and sewage as it went down to the Sea of Cortez. But you could hop a fence right into orange groves in one part of town, and there was Yuma, which was 10,000 times more interesting than Nogales. Los Angeles was in striking distance. It was all happening in San Luis. Maradona was hooked up with a major operation there. He was heading out soon on a Tres Estrellas bus. All Jesus had to do was say the word,